Would you like to accelerate your career and reach your full potential in just minutes a day? Welcome to the LeadX Show with New York Times bestselling author and Inc. 500 entrepreneur, Kevin Cruz.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the LeadX Show. I am Kevin Cruz, back again to help you to stand out and to get ahead. On today's show, I talk to an Army four-star general about creed versus values, the open door policy, and playing to our strengths. And you will not believe the free online course we're offering over at leadx.org today. You're going to love it. And since we change the free course of the day every single day, and I don't really know when you're listening to this show, I don't know which course you're going to see, but I still think you're going to love it. Every single day, a new free online video course on management, leadership, productivity, and more. You can also get access to our on-demand catalog through the LeadX Academy. Again, it's at leadx.org. Our quote of the day, I'm going to give you three quotes, given who our guest is and what she has accomplished. The first, from Napoleon, "An army marches on its stomach." The second quote, "Forget logistics, you lose." Lieutenant General Franks, USA Army, 7th Corps Commander in Desert Storm. And finally, from General Robert Barrow, United States Marine Corps, "Amateurs think about tactics, professionals think about logistics." That brings me to our guest today. She is the first woman in the U.S. military to have achieved the rank of four-star general, which she received in 2008 as a member of the U.S. Army. After 37 years of service, she retired from the Army in 2012. In her last assignment, she led and ran the largest global logistics command in the Army, over 69,000 military and civilian personnel in over 140 countries, and with a budget of over $60 billion. Billion with a B. She also managed the Army's global supply chain in support of operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. Today, she's the president of First to Four, a leadership mentoring company, and she also serves on the board of directors for L3 Communications, K-Force, and Logistics Management Institute. Her book, A Higher Standard, was released in April 2015. Our guest is General Ann Dunwoody. General, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Kevin.
Now, we kind of have a tradition on this show where doesn't matter who the guest is, I always start with the same first question because I think failures can be stepping stones. You know, I always say there's no win or lose, only win or learn. So I'm hoping you'll start by telling us about one of your best failures and what did you learn from it?
Well, first, I agree with you. There is no win or lose in lessons in life. It is win or learn. And I would say, and I thought about this, I would say the best, but also the hardest lesson that I learned was that I was not invincible. Leaders aren't invincible. And in the military, we like to think that everyone's invincible. And we like to, you know, that we can do anything, take that hill, jump out of the airplane, run 12 miles, ruck march, and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
No whining is allowed, just suck it up. And as a young captain, I found myself in a position where I didn't like my job. I didn't like where I was living, and my marriage was falling apart. And I just sucked it up and pretend like everything's hunky-dory. And I started getting feeling really sick. And so I went to see a doctor, and he did some tests. And he said, are you under any stress? And I said, stress? I got the easiest job over here. I don't like it, but it's really easy. So, no. And then it kind of hit me that I didn't like my job. I didn't like where I was living. And my marriage was falling apart. Here I'm from a Catholic family. And I hadn't talked to anybody. I just sucked it up. And he said, well, you got a bleeding ulcer and you better take care of yourself.
Wow.
And so I flew home to see my parents, scared to death that they were going to think I was a failure. And they were the most supportive parents one could ever have expected. And it was like the weight of the world was lifted off my shoulders. And I went back to Germany. I separated from my husband, interviewed for a new great job, and moved into a new house with my dog. And Ann Dunwoody was back.
Wow.
But the lesson is we're just human beings. You know, at the end of the day, we're all human. And when the stress in your life is more than your body can take, it's going to react, whether it's your hair falls out or bumps. And I could point to hundreds of cases that I've seen where people have either breakdowns or, you know, because they haven't dealt with it, they suck it up. So find the confidant, find a friend, find someone you can share the good news and the bad news in your life with.
I really appreciate you sharing that story. And to me, that was one of your most powerful stories in the book. And what's interesting to me, there's a lot of things that are interesting. And one, it's that this time of the bleeding ulcer and having all of this self-doubt about certain areas of your life only really happened when you actually got to a fairly easy job in the Army. You weren't thrilled with being in that job. You wanted a more demanding type role. But it's when the job had less pressure that all of a sudden everything else seemed to have bubbled up.
Yeah, well, I had to, in order to be assigned with my husband, I had to go over in my alternate specialty, which was personnel, which is very important, but it's not as exciting as the business I was in, jumping out of airplanes. And
right.
And so I thought it was the perfect time to have a family, actually, because I'm in this easy job. And I find out my husband didn't want to have kids. That was quite a eye opener.
Right.
Marrying a Catholic girl. And that's when it all started unraveling. So I don't think it really had to do with the job. It was a combination of things.
And I speak to a lot of leaders, senior leaders in companies, but as well as in the service. And it seems like more and more everybody's acknowledging that to be vulnerable and to share the way you just have as an example is actually a sign of strength. Strong leaders have the courage to share some of what they're struggling with personally. I mean, do you think we're making strides in changing the culture, not just in the service, but, you know, everywhere in the organization to open up more?
I do still think there's people that have a, you know, coat of armor on them, you know, and that they would never open up. But I think we certainly are getting better. And I think it's really important because the consequences of not doing so. And today, you know, people start worrying and self-doubt and think about terrible alternatives that when we were growing up, weren't even on the menu, you know, taking lives.
Right.
And so I think it's so important that when you have issues, that it's okay. It's okay, you know, and you deal with them. And you'd probably do better in your job because you're dealing with the personal side that we have kept so close hold.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So I'm curious also, before we turn more to your book, you know, what leadership advice would you give to, you know, a younger first-time manager? You know, she wants to excel as a leader, but this is her first time leading people. What would you say to her?
You know, I would say no matter what level you are, but particularly for the new ones, that make every person on your team count. Everybody has something to contribute. And if you can bring the best out in each of your team members, then you're going to have a great team. But that also requires you to reward good behavior. So when you have those folks that are exceeding the standards and doing a great job for your team, that you acknowledge that. You pat them on the back, you shake their hand, you give them the t-shirt, you give them the bonus, whatever. And likewise, the harder part of that equation is when you have people that aren't meeting the standard, that are dragging the team down, that you deal with those as well, either corrective counseling or, you know, try to make them get on the team, get on board, or you have to do something and not let them drag the team down. Because what that does, and I believe this, people want to be part of a high-performing organization. They want to, you know, make a difference, but they want to be appreciated. And so when you recognize those, people are going to get on that side of the team. They want to be part of those that are getting the handshake and the pat on the back. No one wants to be told they're a laggard and they're not doing well and they're not doing their part. And so in my experience, that's really how you build high-performing organizations from the smallest level, smallest team, first job, to the highest level. Of course, it gets harder the bigger the organization.
Right.
But it's still that necessary evil. So reward the good performance, take care of the ones that aren't carrying their load, and create a high-performing organization.
And I think that advice, especially about addressing those who aren't meeting the standard, I really struggled with that as a young leader. As I look back to, especially when I was in my 20s or even early 30s, I was so non-confrontational. You know, I didn't want to hurt anybody's feelings or have a fight, especially if I was sort of friendly with them. And I think I confused being friendly at work with having friends at work, which made it difficult to give that corrective feedback. Did it come natural to you to give that kind of constructive criticism? I would think that kind of comes as just part of Army culture, or is it something you had to grow into as well?
I think you get better each time, but it doesn't always have to be a confrontation. Sometimes it's just education. We all have blind spots. And so someone may not know that they're not carrying their load, and here's what the others think of them, or making those on-spot corrections when you see the wrong thing. Some of it doesn't always have to be, you know, a chewing out, you know, and that you're really a, you know, poor performer.
Right.
And I've seen so many people turn around because, one, they didn't know, or two, you say, you know, you really disappointed me today. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, that's worse than anyone name calling than anything. If someone tells me they're disappointed in me, I'm like, oh, wow. And that found that worked for me. So it doesn't have to be, you know, always so negative and something that is a blow.
Right.
But if you make them feel bad and they still don't respond, then you probably have a guy or gal doesn't really care, you know.
Right. And that's a whole different issue.
That's a whole different issue.
Now, General, your book again is A Higher Standard: Leadership Strategies from America's First Female Four-Star General. And let's start with, why did you choose that title, A Higher Standard?
That's a great question. When I joined the Army back in 1975, I thought as a woman, because there weren't very many, they just started, I joined the WAC Corps, matter of fact, Women's Army Corps, and then a year later they disbanded that and started the integration. So when I decided to stay, I just assumed that as a woman in this man's world, that I would have to exceed the standards, all of them, in order to be accepted into the ranks. And I tried to do just that. But as I continued my journey in the military, what I discovered was that all the good leaders that I worked for, all the good leaders that I respected, and I never worked for a woman, I worked for all male leaders that either respected me or didn't, they held themselves to a higher standard and they encouraged their subordinates to do the same.
Wow. So it's like your very first leadership principle.
It kind of took a while for me to come around to it because, you know, it wasn't until I probably retired and got to reflect back on it that I compare, you know, people that don't meet the standards or exceed the standards. And it's kind of like, if you exceed the standard, you got A students. If you meet the standards, it's a C student. And if you don't, you know, and if you have a team of C students that are okay with just meeting the standard, you're probably going to have an average team.
Right.
But if you have a team full of folks, A students, that are always trying to exceed the standard, do the best for the organization, that you're probably going to have a high-performing organization.
Makes a lot of sense. Now, I want to ask you a question, and I'm pretty sure you've never been asked before in your publicity tours. What jumped out at me when in reading your book was how often you referenced creed. And as a civilian, you know, I kind of paused after the second or third time, and I certainly knew the dictionary definition of creed and Apostles' Creed, but I thought, you know, I read a lot of leadership books, and nobody's really talking about the importance of creed as much as you do. In fact, you know, you use the word creed 22 times through the book, which is more than twice as often as you talk about values, which obviously there are also U.S. Army values. And that made me think about, isn't this interesting? In the private sector, in the business world, a lot is made out of corporate values, or at least, you know, coming up with them and putting them on the wall, and whether or not people remember them or live them is a whole separate conversation. But I thought, I've never really heard private sector leaders talk about a creed for their company or for their department. So I'm fascinated by this. Talk to me about creed for you, creed in the U.S. Army, and do you find it more valuable to you than, say, the universal Army values?
Well, I think first, values are enduring, and that's our culture. On the creed part, of course, everyone in the military, as you know, takes an oath, And that's pretty significant. Support and defend the Constitution of the United States. That's pretty heady stuff for a little 18-year-old guy or gal or anyone else for that matter. The creeds, as you go through the military, what I find is that they're unifying. When you get a special skill set, like getting your airborne wings, there's a creed associated becoming a paratrooper. And it's a unifier for all paratroopers. We are special. Mm-hmm. We feel special. And we've just accomplished something above and beyond the normal Army soldier. And the same with a Ranger. You go to, they have a Ranger's creed. It's very unifying, very powerful. And it makes them feel special that they have this unique skill set. I was quartermaster, even as a quartermaster branch officer, we had a creed that made me, when I graduated from quartermaster school, and we recited that, proud to be a quartermaster. And of course, so there was many, many creeds throughout the Army for special skill sets for people who had qualified and qualified above and beyond the normal qualifications. And it wasn't until General Schoomaker, our former chief of staff of the Army, came up with the Soldier's Creed. Mm. I thought, like you, that's really powerful. Now you're just not uniting communities within the military, Army. You're uniting all soldiers who live by this creed. It's extremely powerful. And I'll tell you, I just met a very young CEO in a high-tech, small high-tech company. And I was reading about him, and I read, and he had a creed for his company. It was very similar to some of our Army values woven in. Huh. And I asked him about it, and he said, there's a study out that said organizations with creeds actually have higher productivity because people feel united, associated for doing what that creed says that they believe they're doing.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's great insight and gives me some homework to do further study on that area as well. The other thing I wanted to ask you about, my next leadership book comes out later in the year, and it's sort of a contrarian.
Congratulations. It might be the hardest thing I ever done.
Well, so yeah. Exactly. I always say that I hate writing. I only like having written. Once it's in the past tense, right?
Yeah. I'm there. There'll be no number two.
And one of my chapters is called Close Your Open Door Policy. And I purposely take a sort of an over-the-top view of the problems of traditional open-door policies. But in my book, you know, one of the things that I did was I stumbled on that the U.S. Army actually has a regulation around open-door policy.
Of course, you're surprised by that.
But of course, leaves great discretion to the commander, to each commander, on how to implement it. And so as I looked at, you know, some of what I was reading about U.S. Army implementation, of course, the problem is you don't want people jumping the chain of command needlessly, and yet you're also supposed to have access for when there's ethical breaches or you've can't solve a problem. So I'm curious, how did you have an open door policy that worked for you during your career?
I don't think it should have to be a policy. I think it should be like a best business practice, you know. But in course, in the Army, we have policies for everything, and so we have one. But and because we are, as you noted, a hierarchical organization, chain of command, and it's filled with human leaders, and you'd like to think that every leader at every level is always doing the right thing for the right reason. But because there are humans in there, and that there's always, you're always going to have some bad actors. There's got to be a mechanism for folks who either see something wrong or felt they've been wrongly dealt with or want to report higher because they haven't gotten the assistance or whatever they were looking for, that's okay. What I would say is that good leaders are accessible. And if I'm in the chow line and in the dime cell and I'm talking to a private who's in the chow line in front of me, how's it going? How's your barracks? And you get a lot of information. Now, accessible good leaders make poor leaders below them nervous because they want to know what's she telling her, what she talking about, blah, 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 blah. But that's how you can minimize, I think, that because you know what's going on. And another thing around the open doors, I used to have what I called Napoleon's corporals, people I try who would go. Not everyone's going to tell a 4-star general what's good or bad, you know, they or not even talk to you at all. But if you have people out there that are censors for you and said, hey, did you know, or here's what I heard, or here's how, you know, that's another way without the formality of an open door. But I always had an open door, and I always made time for everyone who came in. And you just Some of them are legit, some are not, but you always have to take the time to address the issue.
Yeah, and I like, as you point out, and it's, you know, one of my problems with traditional open door is that it puts, it almost can put the burden of communication down the chain of command, saying, yeah, my door's open, I'm here, but you've got to have the professional courage to walk through. And of course, in any organization, you know, sometimes you could get punished if the wrong person are bringing the wrong things. So people are nervous about that. When you talk about the chow line, I counsel leaders, you know, don't wait for people to come through your door. You walk through out your door. And management, you know, by walking around.
There you go.
And the other thing I was curious about, again, similar, you know, I've got this chapter over the top. I say, you know, leaders don't have rules. And of course, they have some rules. But I talk about how the more policies and things we layer on, the more kind of ridiculous the organization can be and, you know, out of step with the real world. And that's when I stumbled on in doing research, an Army research paper, you know, lying to ourselves, dishonesty in the Army profession, and where apparently, I don't know if it's still true, but as of a few years ago, if you counted up all the mandatory training that needed to be done, it would take more days than there are in a given year. These were, you know, retired officers who did this paper said was, it becomes a culture where they said the phrase, they would pencil whip the reports, you know, saying that things were passed and stuff. And it's been talked about apparently that, look, this culture has to change. We can't mandate everything or accept that people are going to do this. And I mean, what are your own thoughts on this problem, which is in any organization where rules and regulations start to stack up and interfere with the primary task at hand?
Well, Kevin, I think in any bureaucratic organization, of which the Army and the military is, I don't think it's intentional that all of a sudden they were overwhelmed with more than, you know, training rigs. But I do think because it's a bureaucracy, that the first and a response to any issue is more training, more rules, more regulations. And without understanding the second and third order effects of adding that additional regulation, that additional training, and without looking holistically at all the requirements now and taking the old ones that don't apply anymore off the table. And so if without doing that, that puts the onus on the commanders in the field to do two things. One, prioritize it because there's not enough time in the day to do everything that allegedly is being directed. And second, then have to report on those things that you're not doing
right
by directive. And that's hard. That's a bad situation. You don't want to put commanders in, but they have to, you know, if you said, I'd say I couldn't do that. And he's like, you know how that makes anyone feel. No one likes to say they can't do anything, like to say they do everything. But that's the reality of it. And the good commanders have to say and stand up and be counted for and say, I had to do these things because we're going deployed. And so these were my priorities. And I had to have these kind of trainings because we had, you know, whether it was sexual harassment training or whatever. And these are things I just didn't have time for. And then it does get the attention, say, you know, whoever did this paper, and I haven't read it, but I do believe it.
Yeah. That's interesting. And lastly, you know, another thing that's been a hot theme in recent years in the private sector is just sort of this approach of strengths-based leadership, helping our team members to identify their strengths and then to help them to develop them and to sort of put people into roles where they're going to thrive. Do you think there's merit to this? Did you sort of take that approach as a leader in the Army?
Kevin, I'll tell you, two things that I think I learned as I was going through the ranks. And one is what the military does best is develop leaders. And we develop leaders. It is our profession. And we do it through assignment. We do it through professional development. We do it through coaching and mentoring. And we do it through evaluations and selection boards. So that is our core competency, developing leaders. What we don't do well is best business practices. And I found myself as a leader of a logistics, large logistics organization, going out to commercial organizations to leverage their best business practices and try to bring them back into the Army. And I think commercial can leverage our leadership methods and development and bring them into the commercial side of the house. So there's a lot of things when I'm thinking about your question about how do you play to that and how do you allow people to play their strengths? I think it's two ways. One's a self-evaluation. And I ask myself, what do I do well? and one of the things I need to work on throughout my life, because they change depending on your assignment. And I'm a real people person, and I leverage that because I like to talk to people. I like to counsel people. I like to encourage people. I like to coach people. That's, and I still love to do that even in my retired life. What I wasn't good at early on, as you might have read in my book, was public speaking. And I didn't know that until I actually got thrown into the role. And I'm like, gosh, I'm never going to make it unless I work on this. And so playing to your strengths is one thing, but also acknowledging that you have areas for improvement. You need to work on them to make a to really enhance your portfolio as a leader or a manager. And then the other thing I tell folks about playing to your strengths is find your passion that supports those strengths. And if you ask, am I doing something my mom and dad wanted me to do, or am I doing something that I really love to do? And sometimes those things aren't the same. And you might find, if you keep the doors open and try things, when you find your passion, you leverage your strengths and it's not really work anymore like you're doing.
Well, and a follow-up to that, you know, when you were a young woman, you didn't originally plan on joining the Army, right? Even though for my listeners who haven't read your book yet, even though your father was, you know, part of the Greatest Generation, served in three wars, career Army, but you didn't plan originally to join the Army, right?
Right. We had actually have four generations of West Pointers in my family.
Wow.
Back to 1890, well, I can't remember the last one. Anyway, 1818 on. So my brother, my dad, his grandfather and great-grandfather were all West Pointers. And that wasn't open to me when I came in, not that I would have gone anyway. But my sister went in, older sister. She was a third female helicopter pilot. But since I was 5 years old, all I wanted to do was be a coach and a phys ed teacher. I was a tomboy. I love sports. And I went to Cortland State in upstate New York, which was a top 10 phys ed school. That's what I was going to do. And in my junior year in college, the Army was trying to recruit more women. This is at the end of Vietnam War. And they had a program that if you got accepted and qualified, they would pay you $500 a month during your senior year in college, with a 2-year commitment and a commission as a second lieutenant.
Wow.
And $500 was a lot of money back then.
It's a lot of money now, General.
Yeah. And so I signed up knowing that it was just going to be a 2-year detour en route to my coaching, teaching profession. And when I got in, I found I love being a soldier and I love leading soldiers. And, you know, 2 years turned into five, I remember telling my dad, I really enjoy this. And I'm going to stay as long as I can make a difference and enjoy what I'm doing. And I was what I realized at the end, again, this is reflection, not knowing as I'm going along this journey one job at a time, that I really did end up following my passion. I just did it in a different profession, a different classroom, in a very physically demanding profession, the United States Army.
That's incredible. That's a great story. And it's a funny how we wound into that, because I think so many people would have automatically thought, you know, my dad's going to want me to join the Army. And maybe you were forced into it from that family expectation. You're like, no, you've got to find your passion. And originally you didn't think that was going to be it. That's great. General, tell our listeners how we can find out more about your work and your book.
I have a website, anndunwoody.com, and that talks about a higher standard. And on amazon.com, it's there where you can purchase it. It's still got a lot of reviews, and it's still a 5-star review. I'm tickled. You have no idea, you know, when you write a book, what people are going to say about it. So I'm blessed and honored that I get so much feedback from my readers.
Well, we will certainly put those links in the podcast show notes and in the articles on Forbes and the other places that this goes out to. And General, again, thanks for your service. Thanks for an incredible book and for coming on to the LeadX show.
Thank you, Kevin, for having me. And I look forward to your next book. When's that coming out?
September of this year, God willing.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thanks, General. LeadX family, that wraps up another episode filled with leadership advice. But before I go, I hope you remember that at LeadX, we're on a mission to give free leadership training and professional development to everyone, anywhere, at any time. Visit leadx.org to check out our free course of the day and our weekly live webinars. And for your friends and colleagues who are managers, they lead people, let them know that they can get over 30 best-in-class management training courses on demand at their own pace at leadx.org for a ridiculously low investment of $7 per month. This is our public beta pre-launch pricing, and that quadruples really soon. Check out the LeadX Academy at leadx.org. And if you're the kind of person who always says thank you, then please take 1 minute, it's actually less than a minute, and go leave a rating for the LeadX show on iTunes. Just go to leadx.org/subscribe, and it's going to bounce you to the right page on iTunes. You can just click some stars, maybe click that subscribe button, and if you have 20 more seconds, you could write a one-sentence review of the show. It's the single best way for us to build our family. And of course, because leadership is influence, and we are leading all of the time, it's a question of, are you leading in a positive direction or a negative direction? I implore you to be mindful with your influence, to be mindful with your leadership. How will you lead today?